Welcome, everyone. This is the continuation of the series on the seven factors of enlightenment, and tonight we're on factor number three. That factor is energy. Even though I break these talks apart in terms of separate talks for each factor, they aren't really separable. They're not really indistinguishable in some ways. There are slight perceptual shifts that we can make when we look at one factor as opposed to another. But they're so interdependent that really they are not extractable from one another in a real important sense of that. So we're looking at the sense of energy. Not just any energy, but resolute energy, uplifting energy, the urge to practice. In Buddhism, the word chanda, that means zest or uplifting energy, sort of the life force energy. And in the days of the Star Wars movies, may the life force energy be with us all, because it's extraordinarily important. That energy, of course, can take many different avenues and directions depending upon the mind which the energy is moving through. And that's why energy itself is a neutral quality. It's neither wise nor ignorant, but the mind that holds that energy and allows that energy to manifest holds the ignorance or the wisdom, which either distorts it or aligns it in harmony with the way things are. And so it's important to sort of understand dharmically, as we become less controlling in our practice, when we become less willful, this is the way the Dharma marches us, this is the journey of awakening, is that we become less and less instrumental in our own awakening, and we take a back seat, you might say, to the normal way that we conduct our life, which is often very influential and self-concerned. Now, as that occurs, as we begin to become less self-directed, less demanding upon life and ourselves, then the energy becomes more aroused. This energy, this life force, begins to move in accordance with the natural laws of life rather than the unnatural laws of our own sense of self-discipline or self-control. And so really what we're doing in meditation, or one way to perceive it, is to release ourselves for the natural movement of this energy to manifest in body, speech, and mind. And but mostly what we do is that we don't trust energy to move undirected, do we? And so we play director, producer, and stage manager of our lives. And lack of faith that this energy could have any inherent intelligence in and of itself when it's not directly applied by the sense of me. And so it's interesting because when we feel out of control, that is that we're not able to control our lives, being out of control hasn't been particularly helpful in our life. In fact, it's often disastrous. Now, why is that? If we're suggesting that that is the mechanism, that is the way, that sense of release is the way towards freedom, why is it that when we lose control, it doesn't seem very freeing at all? It's because that energy, of course, can go in accordance with two different, very different, and diametrically opposed directions. One is with the understanding of what the sense of self is, and the release of that energy through the awareness and wisdom of the sense of self, it will move in accordance with the harmonies of life. When it's being smothered, resisted, trampled on, identified with, unconscious, then it's going to move in accordance with the sense of self, the sense of me. And that's where all trouble it comes from. It comes from the distortion that the mind has upon the basic and natural path of energy. And it's distorted to become a very selfish, contracted, and isolated form, an expression of life, rather than one that's interconnected and related, which is at the truth of things. But the self can't see that. So you can see how it is that we, as Dharma students, have to unleash the energy, not with reckless abandonment, but with understanding of what this sense of inhibition, protection, obstruction is. Why is it that I'm resisting or bottling the energy up? And then there, once it's understood how the strategies of me really constrain that energy, then it can move in accordance with the natural laws of life and not in accordance to my demands. Non-resistant energy. So this sense of seven factors, let me just go through the two factors we've done prior to tonight. The first factor was the factor of mindfulness. And that factor is a very important factor because unless we see, unless there's light, nothing can be seen. So mindfulness, however we get there, we have to turn on the light. And sometimes getting across the room to the light switch is perhaps the most difficult aspect of the practice for us. We'd rather grope around in the dark. We'd rather bump our heads, crash into walls, anything but have to turn on the light. But eventually, somehow, most of us in this room have found the light switch. Now, is that good enough? Is mindfulness good enough? No, it's not. There must be awareness. There must be curiosity within that awareness. Awareness itself is just aware and will be willing to put up with positions and fixed responses that have led us throughout our entire life. But if there's a curiosity within that awareness, which we have called in the second factor, investigation, that sense of curiosity is really essential. Because the sense of curiosity doesn't just allow old patterns to exist because they've always existed, when in fact those old patterns, in some degree of subtlety, when we notice subtly, that they cause us pain and contraction and difficulty and conflict. Then the curiosity comes in and says, what's going on here? What's this about? What's this conflict about? Why is there hurting in this moment? And it's with that infusion of curiosity in mindfulness, that investigative sense of what it is and why it is that the status quo is not acceptable. Never acceptable to investigation. And investigation, what it does is it allows us to see where it is that we are contracted around a particular mental event in our life and how that contraction is binding the energy, keeps it constrained, keeps it reined in, obstructing. Resistance, even in physics, means that you're going to have some shunting of the energy. And certainly resistance, mental resistance to ourselves, shunts the energy away from its natural current, from its natural circuitry. So investigation, when the curiosity is not just trying to get over, because that's the domain of what the self tries to do. It tries to get over its problem. It doesn't try to understand its problem. So if we work in the domain of the self, then investigation is going to try to alleviate the problem in the quickest way it knows how, the quickest fix, through pill or punishment. But investigation, curiosity, looks at the problem itself anew. As soon as we look at a problem anew, rather from the old fixed position of how I've always known myself to be this way, but anew, in an unfixed way, then you can already feel that the energy is released from that unfixed response to the challenge that's there in the moment. So investigation unleashes the energy. But the investigation, the curiosity, must be in the service of wisdom, not in the service of ignorance. The service of ignorance, curiosity, as I mentioned, just adds to the dimension of me, just reaffirms the old conditioned way. But when it's not in the service of me, which it means that it's not in a fixed position, but looks at something anew, let me look at this problem. Let me look at this knee pain that has been driving me insane for 20 years of meditation practice. Let me look at it finally. Let me look at it. See, in the looking, there's an opening. When you look at something without a fixed opinion about it, you're being open to it. Well, you can already feel that the pressure off, the non-resistance of that openness is the very expression through which energy can pour. And we wonder, you see, why is it that we don't have or doesn't seem to have enough energy? Because we constantly shunt our energy into either cultural or intrapsychic distortions. For instance, when I was in Thailand, I was doing a long self-retreat in this enclosed kuti, a little hut, and they had a picture of a very austere and severe Ajahn who was dead even 25 years ago, but his glare was not dead, believe me. And he looked like a tiger in a lotus position. And I was doing my sitting and walking. I look up at this beast on the wall, and I said, I can't live with that thing. So I turn the picture flat against the wall, because you see. Oftentimes, the cultures from which these traditions come out of understand the limitation or the way the energy of that culture is being distorted or being diverted. In Thailand, there is a saying, Maipenrai, Maipenrai. Maipenrai means never mind. And it's a kind of lethargic, sort of, you know, like anything, okay, just anything, you know, it's okay, my can run, never mind. That sort of, in the worst sense of that phrase. And so to have an Ajahn who's fierce, whose very gaze can shock you out of that my can run spirit, is very helpful. But to a Westerner who brings that stern gaze to the meditation, it's not helpful. And we often run across into these cross-cultural matches. And we think we should just take on the whole thing. Whatever Japanese cultural overlays are to our particular practice or whatever Tibetan overlays are. Nonsense. We have a unique cultural heritage here. And how is to ask that from a unique question, from a unique sense of investigation? How is it that our culture, and I'll start there, but I won't let each of us off the hook, is distorting our energy? Because really what I find is the disease of this culture is self-defeatism. Self-defeatism, psychic scarring. And there's a spiritual death in that. It's, in some ways, I'd like to say it's worse then, but it's equally as bad as the Mai Pen Rai spirit. There's a feeling I can't muster enough energy to even do this anymore. Just get me through the day, sort of thing. I don't know. Each of us will have to take stock of how that's imploding in each one of us. But it's a disease of the spirit, lethargy of the spirit, rather than of the body. And the energy through that self-defeatism is blocked irreparably unless we start investigating it. And so we do. We have to. Because each one of us is a perfect conduit. A unique and perfect conduit for all the energy of the universe to pour through us. And it is the emotional way we hold the world that keeps it from fruition. It's not you don't lack energy. You have just coalesced or condensed around a particular impersonation and believed in that impersonation. And so the energy never can't come through the wires. It's being grounded even before it can come through our body and mind. You know, I do the homework because something to ignite us. But I can see how the way most of us pick up the homework and read it, that it hasn't ignited us at all. It's another thing that goes perhaps as a bookmarker. I keep trying to figure out ways to bring us into this essential quality of energy, to raise us up. So how do we arouse energy? How do we do that? You see, energy gets corrupted by not feeling the sense of completion here and now. We start with the problem. The problem in spiritual work is that we don't feel complete here and now. And so we look outside of ourselves for that completion. Well, how that manufactures in terms of our behavior is that we run after our desires. We run after the things we want outside of ourselves, and by acquiring that which is outside of ourselves, we think that's going to bring completion. And when we bring that, ingest or hold on or grasp that thing which is outside, and we bring it so that it is here, we have a moment of satisfaction in terms of a feeling tone. The end of a desire. The desire is no longer craving because it's satisfied, and that end of that craving for driven by the sense of incompletion is momentarily halted. And we feel that must be what contentment really is. But only to ignite a new desire and to run anew after the new sense of completion. Well, that corrupts our energy. When we can understand that unless we find contentment here and now, that the energy will always be a futuristic energy. It'll always have its sense of alignment when, if, in expectation of, not now. And energy is now. Energy can't be postponed or put off until something is acquired for energy to arise. Energy is now. Now is the time when we are 100% energetic, if we can find the ability and willingness to find the contentment and not move in the distorted way, which our desires tell us, which that it's in the next moment, or the moment after that, or the moment after that. So you can see that wisdom must follow this. Must follow. I would have probably a class three times as large as this if I started talking about self-improvement. Because we all want to hear that. That's what we're geared to invest our energy in. That's where we feel like the real essence of our life on earth is. It just isn't true. That's all. And to invest your life into that pursuit will never bring you the fulfillment of your own energy. Never. It would increase my Donna stakes, but it won't do a thing for us. And it gets blocked now, because when we look at ourselves now, when we're constantly being refocused, redirected back to here and now, all we have when we look at ourselves is a sense of defeat. We feel defeated, that it must be in the future because there I may not be defeated. Here, I'm left with the scars of my past. I'm left with the lethargy of my spirit. And so our energy gets modified by our fear to be, our fear to be fully alive, a fear of being fully alive. We've tried it before and we got whacked. And so our energy gets mixed in kind of a fear and ignorance blend. Listen to this quote by Woody Allen. See if you can hear the fear and ignorance of this quote. To love is to suffer. To avoid suffering, one must not love. But then one suffers from not loving. Therefore, to love is to suffer. Not to love is to suffer. To suffer is to suffer. But suffering makes me unhappy. Therefore, to be unhappy, one must love, or love to suffer, or suffer from too much happiness. I hope you're all getting this. So you can, I mean, it's done in good humor, but you can hear the logic muddled of ignorance, and we have to straighten that out. We have to. How are we going to do that without curiosity? What is this lethargy I'm feeling? See, already when we ask the question, energy is there. Already the light is no longer a 20-watt, but now it's a 40-watt bulb. We've heightened the crescendo of our life just in asking the question, just in having the curiosity to ask. But we're afraid that on the other end of that asking is more defeat. It'll show me why I feel the way I'm feeling if I pursue that question. Therefore, I won't pursue that question to confirm the person I really feel I am. I'll avoid that question and thereby avoid my whole life by not asking. Listen to this. Let it get in. Let this get in. Because without the energy, where's the effort? Where's the wise effort? Unless the energy is in accordance with wisdom, effort will be in accordance with the ignorance. Unless we have investigated and thereby released the binding force of that, of wherever our energy was shunted, unless we are able to investigate and release that, it will remain shunted because we are asking the wrong question. If there's a maxim If there's something I could send you away with in terms of the safety of as a Dharma style of life for each one of us, it would be to use your energy to seek more understanding. So that you're constantly unfixing wherever it is you think your life is. Wherever you think you are, use your energy to unfix that position, and you will always be moving dharmically in right alignment. If you use it to further fix your position, to further convince your story, then we are going adharmic, against the Dharma. So ask questions that deeply, deeply move to the roots of the problem, not questions that further burden the problem itself. At some point, when we start asking the right questions and moving the right energy in the alignment, we're unwilling to contract anymore. The sense of contraction is a cue itself to ask a further question. But we have to learn how to do that, because when we're always in a contracted state, it's not obvious that that isn't the status quo. That isn't who I am. That isn't the definition of me. But when we begin to ask the right questions, which uproot the problem, and we find ourselves going back into those old problems, that sense of going back has a contracted feel to it that becomes intolerable to us. Our heart closing down. Righteousness. Vengeance. Or any other sense of conflict and inward struggle. Unwilling to do that. Unwilling to waste my life convincing the posture and fixed position I'm in. Making that a truth of my life. Making that a truth. Unwilling to do that. Once we experience the possibility of a new way, we can't turn around. We can't go back. All you need is just a couple of times to do that, called insight. Then you're forever on this journey. You cannot get off the path then, because you can't pretend anymore that the contracted form of the expression of energy is you, is true. Can't do that. So when we look at pain then, we can, wherever the pain may be, are we open to that pain? Because if we're open to that pain, we're connected with it. When we're connected with it, the energy has a different expression to it, has an expression of love. When there is pain and we are contracted around pain, that has its own expression, emotional. The energy comes through emotional expression of aversion, avoidance, resistance, struggle, conflict. That's how it feels in us. That's the way a shunted or distorted energy feels. It feels angry. It feels vengeful. It feels self-critical. And when we're open to pain, that sense of openness, you can see, you can, as I use the words, you can feel the circuits line up. When we're open to pain and all of its implications, yes, there is a pain still there, the pain of perhaps the pain of the grief of what we've been doing to ourselves, the sense of, but it's a tender pain. It's a pain of unity, a pain of uniting. Someone called me today and was from another city and was telling me about how she just has an unending grief in her practice. And wherever she sees or looks out in the pain of the world, she just feels the grief of that. But I said, well, describe that pain to me. And she talked about the tenderness of it, the delicacy of it. You see, you can feel the words of the heart coming through that display of energy. Yes, it's painful to open to the pain of the world and to what we've been doing to ourselves. But it feels very different than the pain of vengeance or anger. It tastes very different. And this is all about developing a more refined sense of taste. So we become connoisseurs of life. We know exactly what it feels like on our tongue. I worked for a while with some prisoners in Oregon State Penitentiary. And there was one that some of the prisoners were forming a hospice unit within the prison and taking care of dying inmates. So there was one man who had been in prison for 12 years, and at age 18 he had killed his best friend in a moment of rage. His best friend, he killed him. So he'd gone to prison at age 18, and 12 years later, he had befriended his best friend in prison was dying, and he was the hospice volunteer for his dying best friend. And it so happened that his dying best friend in prison died on the same day that he had killed his best friend that got him into prison. Same day. And the chaplain who was telling me this story said that he could not deny the pain of either one of those events, that they merged together, and that he was overwhelmed by the suffering that he had caused. And through that, the acknowledgement of that, taking responsibility of that, no longer blaming that on what his friend had done 18 years ago or whatever, there was a common tenderness of heart that the chaplain said continued and was his real rehabilitation. You see, when the energy is blocked, when it's thwarted, when it's distorted, how we hold the nature of events internally is very different than when it is in alignment. What is the way that we hold internal events when the energy is distorted? We blame ourselves, others. We despair. We become self-defeated. But with wisdom, with the right alignment of that energy, we don't hold events that way. We just take responsibility. Okay. All right. Both in the immediacy of the moment, when we do unskillful things, but also in terms of our self-forgiveness in the past. We hold the fact that we did that. Yeah, I did that. But we don't stake ourselves to the ground of that moment in a fixed position to that. I acknowledge it. I own it. I take full responsibility. I feel it completely. Now let's move on. Let's move on. But fear, you see, fear is what binds us to that sense of distortion. Fear. What are some of the common fear patterns which distort our energy again and again and again? One of the greatest fears in any culture, but is certainly prevalent in this one, is the need to conform. The fear to be authentic. How can the energy for that is you, that is uniquely you, ever come through you when you're conforming away from your authenticity? How can we ever be reached by the universe? How can we ever acknowledge that we're even in touch with the universe when we aren't willing to be ourselves? To be authentic. These aren't big words, but they point to a very big problem. These are words that we all love and crave. To be authentic. But to see that sense of authenticity is only approachable when we're true to who we are. To who we really are. To the truth of our being. And that requires the release of the fear of being unprotected. Well, you can feel it when you're afraid, you're protected. When we're protected, we're shunted, we're resistant. Half energy, you can hear the words as whether there are going to be blockages to energy or conduits for energy. Fear, resistance, contraction, the energy is not moving. So we have to investigate, be curious about fear. The need to conform. It's a tragedy, you know, because we are on this earth very unique, as a very unique expression. Nothing, there's no one, no person exactly like you or me. And we keep giving up our place in life. We keep disowning our place in life. Disallowing our place in life. Partially because we don't feel worthy of our place in life. We don't feel deserving to even be on the earth. We question through despair whether we even have a legitimacy here. And then we have, based on that, the expression, a permeation of that, permutation of that, is the fear of making a mistake. One of the most valuable teachings I received as I was just beginning my teaching was a very senior teacher telling me, don't be afraid of making mistakes. Don't be afraid of that. Because I was getting into teaching from feeling the heavy weight of Dharma and having to deliver it to the ears of countless people and not knowing how to do that and feeling more bottled up, tripping over my words instead of relaxing and just let the energy out. Let it come. Let it come. Not to be afraid of mistakes. We're only afraid of mistakes when we think they point to a personalization of the person who made the mistake. If they give you a label, if they reaffirm what we believe we are before we made the mistake, and then the mistake reconfirms what our worst fear is, that we are that bad. That's why mistakes feel so bad to us. We can't relax with ourselves. Again, feel the word and feel it in relationship to energy. Relaxing. Letting be. And again, a permutation of that is the sense of self-doubt. We can't hold ourselves to the ground we're on. When we self-doubt. All of this, various forms of authenticity, various forms of distorted energy. And we, for a long period of time, we can use the practice to try to live up to the expectation of the reading of what an enlightened being is supposed to produce. And we strive after that. Even people who have practiced a long time. Sometimes I run into somebody who's been practicing many, many years. I say, how's your practice going? How's your practice going? This happened one time, but I know there are others out there. And he said, I've stopped sitting. I said, why that? Why is that after all the years that you've done it? He says, oh, it just didn't pay off. It didn't. It said, it promised a certain thing, it never gave me. What do you say? What do you say? What do you say to that? When the very thing it promises is alignment, not productivity. It doesn't promise something. It promises understanding. It promises wisdom. It promises an open heart. It promises energetically aligned with your authenticity. That's what it promises. And if we follow the expectation over and above this moment's expression, the promise will always be unfulfilled. If we look ahead of ourselves, the very looking itself is the distortion of energy that will confirm that the problem still remains. Wise understanding and energy need to march hand in hand, foot by foot, step by step. And the most basic form and expression of wise understanding is that we're okay the way we are. That we need not look ahead of ourselves to join with the perfect me. That it's just how we hold the story, the backlog of events in our life, and the conclusion we have formed from that backlog that has come to the psychic and attitudinal response we have in this moment. But this moment is undefined, unfixed. This moment is unfixed. This moment is not fixed. So what happens to the backlog of events that has confirmed me being who I thought I was? It's afloat. It's in movement. It's in transition. And therefore, to say anything about you in this moment is wrong. Has to be. By definition. Now the energy can flow. Why? You feel it. Because everything has broken apart, is now fluid, flowing, fluid, unfixed. That's the way things are. Then energy can flow through into the way things are. The way things are. Not the way we want them to be. Not the way we expect them to be. Not the way we fear them to be. But the way things are. Now the whole thing can get moving again. So how do I arouse energy? What do I do to arouse it? To come into alignment? Curiosity, investigation. Investigation. You see how each of the factors, when understood, add to the next. And if you need some outside impetus, reflect on your death. Get yourself into the, not fearfully, like I've got to, not with panic, but whether you're going to last as long as you perceive yourself to, or expect yourself to. And how precious this moment is. See, it takes you into the moment. Panic takes you out of the moment. I've got to do something. But this takes you into the preciousness of the moment. Preciousness. That's where the homework points for this week. Into the preciousness of it. I could die doing this. Really. Not I'm afraid that this could be the last time. What if it was the first or last time you did, whatever you were doing, how would you relate to that? That action, that touch, that sight. Arouse what's inspiring to you. What's inspiring to you? What brings the energy up? Where do you stretch? Where do you go above that which is normal and typical? Where do you move outside of your conditioning? What inspires you up? Up, out for a moment in that voice of inspiration, in that message. What is it? Is it a great work of, is it a poem? Or music, when you can reach up, when you know yourself in alignment in that moment, you can feel it. Where are we emotionally fried, burned out? Where we're romanticizing our place in the world, or what the problem may be? That's where we're going to lose energy. To keep ourselves here, not losing ourselves in some sort of romantic picture of life, right here, with Tent City. When I got involved in hospice care, most of the people in hospice got involved to help the dying. I got involved in hospice to learn about death and dying. And therefore my energy was never depleted because everybody I touched died. And it wasn't, I knew that going in. I didn't have any misperceptions of that. And I didn't find any fault in them dying. And I was fascinated by the subject. And so there was no burnout. I didn't live in an idealized world that didn't contain death. And so to bring ourselves out of the common and ordinary, where we are held through the fixed ways that we perceive ourselves or our relationship to life, to begin unfixing that, to begin to uplift, to begin to stretch, to begin to ask pertinent questions that uproot the problems that keep us fixed, that keep us in a particular posture, in a particular position. Not letting that sense of lethargy be a self-description. This is just the way I am. Like you want, then you go, you, eventually the theology from lethargy is, oh, I go to heaven. I'll go to heaven and be taken care of there, where I can finally have and the idealized world, and everything I need and want. That's the theology from apathy. Not from energy, not from alignment. I find it here, and I don't give a damn about anything else. It's not going to be in heaven. It's going to be here. And that's it. There's nowhere else to look. And just in taking that stand, suddenly we're back on the earth. Suddenly we're touching here. Suddenly we are deserving to be here. Suddenly we have made a statement that uproots the very quality of lethargy itself. Suddenly we are spiritually alive and energy is in alignment and we are on top of it. That's the spirit. You can see what it's called, what's being called for here. Don't listen to this and think, oh, I can't ever do that. That's the emotion talking, not the truth. Challenge. Let me see. May we all see. Thank you. So if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to entertain them. Yes.
Yes. Established in one at all.
Right.
Real, but I'm so unestablished.
Yes.
And the other is where everybody belongs. And I don't,
right.
I mean,
right. The question is that she feels between a rock and the hard place, between a sense that it's the normal and typical patterns and ways that people operate is the norm for her, and yet there's a side, there's a stimulation of the heart that knows or senses that something can be there, but that's disorienting, and you feel like a baby there, feel like a child. You always feel like a child in this one. You won't ever feel sophisticated if you do it right. You won't ever feel like you have a handle on it, because as soon as you do, you're fixed again. Now, it doesn't mean that there isn't a growing sense of confidence that comes, or a growing sense of come what may. That has its own momentum. And because you're on to the signs and symptoms of the disease, and you begin to see that if you stay within the entrapped disease of the typical and the ordinary, that that's far worse than being in unfamiliar territory. That you can't tolerate the familiar any longer. Even though the unfamiliar contains maybe some scary things. And so I encourage you at this stage to keep walking between the value and limitation of both parts of yourself. The part that loves the redeemable qualities that you have in your life, the values that you're getting out of it, hold that. Look at it. Be willing to ask and see. Be willing to see and ask important questions about those qualities, like, am I going to be able to take these qualities away with me when I die? Are you going to be able to take all the praise and the affirmation and validation with you on your deathbed? Because that's where you're going. So if you know that you're on a train and that that train is going to go to your death, and that what the baggage that you're carrying on the train has to be discarded at the time that the train arrives, when are you going to discard it, you see? Is it really true, good, solid baggage worth carrying? Or is it just laboring? Are you being labored under it? You have to ask those questions. And then, as you begin to naturally release yourself from the need of it, not artificially and not prematurely, but you by seeing its end, then you start knowing, suddenly you're getting lighter, suddenly you're beginning more energetic, suddenly you have available to yourself parts of yourself you never knew before. Suddenly you have no doubt that the unburdening, the unloading, is the essential journey. And that you've just been duped through culture and whatever up until that point by loading more and more onto your boxcar. Suddenly you feel that because you feel it in yourself. And the accompanying fear of being in unfamiliar places, that diminishes. You become confident in that. You begin to get very confident with yourself to look into all the different baggage up in your attic. Don't care anymore. Even if there's a scorpion in one of the, you don't care anymore. Or a snake, whatever. That doesn't matter. I'll work with it. So stay on track. Stay on track. If you're tentative and new into this, then staying around people who are on track can keep you on track. Because the rest of the day, quite likely, you aren't with people who keep you on track. And you can, if you have a tendency towards self-doubt, you'll move into that self-doubt when everybody is moving to the left and you think you should move to the right. right? But if everybody in this room is moving to the right and they sound sane, because you can move in a direction in which there's complete insanity, this has to make sense to you. If it's not logic or rational sense, it's sense of the heart. Well, you know this is something, and you know this. And then you want to be in alignment with that knowing. The knowing above all else. I'm going to be in alignment with that. And if you look very carefully, the sense that the world outside of this Sangha makes doesn't give you that sense of knowing. Doesn't give you the same resolution of being at home in it. So what are you going to believe, you see? You going to go home? Or are you going to stay on permanent vacation? Good. Yes.
I'm feeling that a really authentic self-compassion for my story and my wounds and all that would be a way of losing energy.
You think that the way to move energy is...
A way is what?
Compassion for your story. Compassion for your story, that means something to me, but it may mean something quite different to you. What does it mean to you, compassion for your story?
I haven't done it very much.
So yeah.
I would hold it without judgment, without regret, without trying to change it, just hold it.
Without identification as you being a storyteller?
Yes.
Did you hear what I said?
Yeah.
Without identifying... Because you can hold it very romantically. Oh, I've had such a hard life. But okay. So I'm just playing with where this pendulum can swing. Because you're on very, very touchy grounds. Just the compassion for my story. Compassion for your story is a starting place. Okay, I did what I did. Now move on. Don't just keep the story current in memory and in fact. But okay, if there's some unforgiveness there, feel what you did, why you did it, what you got out of what you're doing, and the pain you caused in doing it. Feeling it, accepting the responsibility for it. Now, pull up the stake and move on. Don't just carry the story along with you. Release yourself. The story is just words in the mind. If you want to hold yourself to words of the mind, why would you want to hold yourself to words of the mind? Those words are constantly changing, are moving through. You're just holding yourself to a certain set storyline so that the words will be familiar to you of all the words that pass through your mind. So you're selecting out certain sentences that this is me and other words that don't, other things that go through the mind, because there's a lot that goes through there, you're discarding. It doesn't make much sense. So be very, very careful with compassion for your story. Compassion is current. Compassion is alive. Compassion is now. It has nothing to do with past remorse and regrets and shames and guilts. It brings us current. And the story is never current. Yes. I had a teacher who said, weirdness is beautiful. All you have to do is change your perception of being dyslexic. And suddenly, it's not a problem. It's actually something very unique and wonderful. You see something very different. And it doesn't mean that there won't be challenges and being able to, but it doesn't hold this huge burden on you. In the moment, listen to where this is. In the moment, right now, where is there a problem? There isn't one. It's when we fabricate a particular expectation or ideal that the problem comes in, which is not living in the moment at all. So you've taken yourself out of the moment in order to be miserably known to yourself. Rather than to live at the crosshairs of freedom and be unknown to yourself. Right.
I didn't know that there could be right or wrong questions. I thought to be curious.
Right. The question is about curiosity and whether, in the talk I gave, whether asking, being curious and asking right questions as opposed to unwise questions. Very much so. There's an art to asking questions. First of all, it's not an intellectual question. The question, curiosity, is about the experience that you're having and what it is that experience is. Have you been assuming a certain thing about that experience that the experience itself cannot confirm? You're not going to be able to see whether that can be confirmed or not by intellectually thinking about it. You have to go to the experience and see whether that confirmation is true by experiencing it. Do you see? Now, so when you ask questions, see whether you're asking questions that reconfirm the experience. Oh, I've always been like this. I probably should do something about it. Maybe I need my mother told me I was too passive and now I need some aggressive training. That's just moving along with the assumption of life that you've always lived, trying to add something to you now that you haven't had, or change or modify yourself. Those are the wrong questions. Right question. What is this? What is this? What's going on here? Who am I? What is this thing? Experience it. The question, the curiosity, is towards experiential. I can't say that enough. If you are mulling over, you're going in the wrong way. The question should not lead to more complicated thinking. It should lead to silence, to stillness, to observation, without judgment, without conclusion. You should stop. See, if I told you that there was going to be, the end of the world was going to happen in 15 seconds. You don't have enough time to call on your cell phone. What do you do in those 15 seconds? This would be the most still room imaginable. Everything would have stopped because life would be living for itself. You see, that's energy. Energy is the life force finding itself. That's what the energy wants. The life force wants to find itself. Discover itself, free itself. And we keep getting in the way of it. Getting in the way of it is asking the wrong things of the life force. It's pretending, it's drawing a picture on the life force and pretending that the life force is that picture, me. The life force is not a thing and certainly isn't an entity. Let it move as a force, as a verb, not a noun. So I have to stop now. Thank you. Yeah.